Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 3rd of June. More than 200 people have been killed and 900 injured in a train crash in eastern India. Rescuers are working through the night. Three more Europeans have been released from Iran following a prisoner swap involving a jailed Iranian diplomat last week. And Japan announces a new multi-billion dollar plan to reverse its declining birth rate, which has hit a record low. Also in the podcast... the British referee abused by fans of the Italian football team Roma. And we look back at the life of the prolific US songwriter Cynthia Vile, who's died at the age of 82. There are conflicting accounts about exactly what happened in the train crash in eastern India. The number of people killed has been rising steadily. The latest report from Odisha State is that more than 200 people were killed and 900 injured when two trains collided. This passenger described what happened.
10 to 15 people fell on me when the accident happened and everything went haywire. I was at the bottom of the pile. I hurt my hand and also the back of my neck. When I came out of the train, I saw someone had lost their hand, someone had lost their leg, while someone's face was distorted. Then I got out of there, and since then, I've been sitting here.
Earlier reports had suggested that three trains had been involved, two on the move and one stationary freight train. But just before we came on air, our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etirajan told me there'd been an update.
The officials are saying that two trains were involved. Both were passenger trains, express trains. One was coming from the eastern city of Kolkata going towards Chennai, and one of them derailed and fell on the opposite track, and another passenger train smashed into those derailed coaches, causing this huge disaster. An average 1,000 people might travel in any of the long express trains. The casualty figure is going up, and the officials are saying hundreds of people have been injured. And the challenge they are now facing is how to get through to those survivors who are trapped inside these compartments. And I've been watching various pictures coming out of the scene where the impact was so powerful, some of the compartments were smashed open, basically cut into half. You can see only the bottom half of the compartment. That means the chances of survival for many passengers were very, very limited. And some of the friends and relatives who were traveling on the same trains, they have been waiting, you know, outside. They were trying to, you know, reach out to these people, but it is going to be a long night for the rescue teams.
Yeah, I mean, all happening in the dark. The accident happened on Friday evening. Some of those pictures showed the train on its side with people standing on top trying to lift survivors out of the carriages.
The challenge the authorities are facing is like manifold. First of all, they have to find enough lights and other equipment to cut through these iron bars and then the jammed doors. And many local residents from nearby villages, they also rush to the scene. And the priority is to pull out many people to safety. And also, those who are injured, they have to be transported to various hospitals. The government has sent various ambulances. But still, people are using private cars and even buses to transport these injured passengers. So the casualty number is likely to go further. And what we hear is many residents from nearby districts are coming forward to donate blood. But the more important thing is the families of those passengers who might be at the other end, like, for example, in the southern city of Chennai or in Kolkata from where they departed, they must be wondering what happened to their relatives. You know, they must be phoning people because this happened in Odisha. As you know, India is a huge country and people speak different languages. So they must be wondering what happened to my relative. That's going to be really, really painful for those families.
Now, what is the safety record of Indian Railways? Because they've been pouring a lot of money into it.
The Indian railway system has improved quite a bit over the years, and the governments have been investing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and we see various new tracks and signaling systems. But it's a huge country, and then it's one of the largest networks in the world. They need billions of dollars for several years to improve the infrastructure. And still it is under state control. Despite that, accidents do happen. It is relatively common where we see, you know, hundreds of minor train accidents happening. That people need to find out the reasons for why this derailment happened, and sometimes it just could be human error, how this was allowed to happen, why there was no time to alert the other train. So these are some of the questions the investigators will have to find out. But again, it is a clear reminder that because train travel is very popular in India, the government needs to invest more to avoid any such disasters in the future.
Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarsan Etirajan. Three men, two from Austria, one from Denmark, have been freed by Iran just over a week after a Belgian aid worker was released in exchange for a jailed Iranian diplomat. The Danish man had been arrested in November on the sidelines of a demonstration. I heard more about the two Austrians from our correspondent Bethany Bell in Vienna.
One of them is a businessman. They're both dual citizens. They have both Austrian and Iranian citizenship. One of them, Kamran Ghaderi, was arrested in 2016. He was given a 10-year sentence in jail on spying charges. Amnesty International has said it was a forced confession obtained under torture, and we understand that he was arrested in 2016 at the airport after he arrived to visit his family there. The other man is Masoud Mossaheb, who's in his 70s, we understand. He was arrested in 2019, and Amnesty says that he had a very unfair trial for what they called vague national security offences. And he's said to have quite serious medical conditions, including heart problems and diabetes.
Bethany Bell in the Austrian capital, Vienna. Belgian officials said the releases were part of Operation Blackstone, named after an English legal expert, William Blackstone, who declared it was better for 10 guilty men to go free than one innocent man to suffer. However, critics of the prisoner exchange say it could encourage Iran to arrest more Europeans to use as hostages. Our Middle East analyst is Sebastian Usher.
This is a deal that's been in the works for a long time now. Essentially, Iran wanted a diplomat who was sentenced in Belgium to 20 years in jail over a foiled bomb attack on an exiled Iranian opposition group, Asadollah Assadi. Now, he was released last week when a Belgian aid worker, Olivier van de Castiel, was also released. What we heard was that these three men who've been released were part of that deal, and essentially that this is the end of this deal. The Belgian government officials today have said that at least 22 Europeans are still detained in Iran. France last week gave a figure of more than 30 EU nationals. And I mean, many of these are people of dual Iranian nationality as well. In the UK, there are still two citizens who are held, and a number of other countries have the same situation. Now, and there's been some criticism from Iranian groups, indeed the Iranian exile group that was the target of the foiled attack that the Iranian diplomat was in prison for. That group essentially has said that these exchanges shouldn't happen because they only encourage Iran. And I mean, governments who've been involved by having their nationals held in Iran have said very much the same thing, that essentially this is hostage taking, that they're used as bargaining chips.
Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher. An astronomer in the US has discovered hundreds of mysterious cosmic threads pointing towards the centre of the Milky Way. The strange filaments, each between 5 and 10 light years long, are said to resemble the dots and dashes of Morse code on a grand scale. The details have been published in the astrophysical journal Letter. Here's our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh.
Dr. Farhad Yousefzadeh said he was stunned to discover the giant cosmic threads that seem to emanate from the centre of the galaxy. They're made of dust and gas, but it's unclear how they were created. The most obvious explanation is that they were formed by the black hole at the centre of our galaxy. If that's the case, then that'll be really interesting to scientists. Black holes are so called because they have such strong gravity that not even light can escape, and so are hard for astronomers to study. But if the one at the galactic centre exerts an influence on the newly discovered cosmic threads, then studying them will give scientists insights into the supermassive black hole at the heart of the Milky Way. and the role it played in the formation of our galaxy.
Palab Ghosh. Sunday marks an extremely sensitive anniversary in China. On the 4th of June 1989, the communist authorities there sent in the army to crush pro-democracy demonstrations in Tiananmen Square. Thousands of people died. Comments about the massacre have long been censored, particularly as the anniversary approaches. But this year, a new location has been included in the clampdown. Anyone searching for Sutong Bridge in Beijing won't find it, as I heard from our China media analyst Kerry Allen.
Sutong Bridge is where a protest took place in October last year, and it was a one-man protest. A man, we don't know his name, took out a banner which was criticising zero COVID lockdowns at the time, but very much criticising President Xi Jinping. And it said, we don't want nucleic acid testing, we want food to eat, we don't want lockdowns, we want freedom. And it came just ahead of the National Congress, which is when President Xi Jinping was voted leader for life. This has now been added to a very, very long list of censored terms, Sutong Bridge, this word. I can't stress, this time of year, any messaging that is seen as critical of the government gets removed. And I mean to the extreme. I mean, for example, Sunday is the 4th of June and the numbers 46, meaning the fourth day, the 6 months, that even gets removed from social media platforms.
And it's not only been taken off the internet, this bridge, they've even removed the road signs.
Yes, if you try to type it into Baidu Maps, Baidu is the equivalent of Google in China, you won't see any results. People try to protest in the most kind of innocuous ways. So, for example, just even standing next to this sign might be seen as a sign of dissent. And in previous years, we've also seen people posting candles. These get removed because a candle is a way of commemorating people who've died. It's also the sign of an anniversary if you have it on a cake. So, yeah, candles get removed, cakes get removed, just pictures of cakes.
But it seems that some internet users are able to get round those restrictions and use like traditional Chinese characters to search for it.
I mean, there are always ways every year that social media users try to get out critical messages of the government. And so sometimes they use traditional characters, which are more commonly used in Hong Kong than mainland China. Sometimes they use English as well. It's always interesting this time of year that you'll see new ways emerging as well. And we will see these at the weekend. So last year, for example, ways that people were protesting, they were taking pictures of light switches rather than candles, and also wearing T-shirts that had black rectangles. The ratio was set at 6x4, again to mark the date, the fourth day, the 6 months.
Kerry Allen. One of the most interesting developments in European media over the past few years has been the emergence in France of CNews. Its critics compare it to the American TV network Fox News. Supporters say it's a place where all opinions can be heard. But the network is never far from controversy, regularly receiving complaints for the views it airs on immigration and Islam in particular. The Minister of Culture has even suggested that the channel should lose its licence. John Lawrenson has this report from Paris.
Le droit européen.
Donc, il faut trouver un port sûr.
C'est possible de finir.
Les gens sont. Ben non, mais ce que vous dites.
Je suis désolé, vous avez tort. Le droit européen.
A typical day on a very atypical free-to-air news channel, and a woman is laying into her regular sparring partner, a former editor of the left-wing newspaper Libération.
Et le droit européen. Le droit.
They're arguing about Paris City Hall's decision to withdraw its financial support for SOS Méditerranée, the NGO that rescues migrants from the Mediterranean Sea and takes them to European ports. Welcome to CNews, a channel owned by the conservative, practicing Catholic billionaire Vincent Bolloré, where about a third of a million people tune in each day to follow the cut and thrust of the culture wars à la française. Maxime Duchesne is one of them.
I first heard about this channel because it was being vilified and ostracized. It was this that got me interested. I couldn't bear the sanitized style of the rest of the media.
Ostracized is sometimes the case. This, for example, was an exchange between a CNews reporter and the new General Secretary of the CGT trade union, Sophie Binet, during one of the recent demonstrations against President Macron's raising of the retirement age. I don't want to reply to CNews, she says. Why, asks the journalist. I don't go on your programmes. You will only talk to certain media outlets. I talk to all media that guarantee freedom of expression and a plurality of points of view. But it does, says essayist Laurent Dandrieux, culture editor at the conservative, some say extreme right, newsweekly Valeurs Actuelles. It's just not the same balance as the one we're used to.
In France, the broadcast media is dominated culturally by the left, so very few right-wing people were ever invited onto this sort of political talk show. CNews is completely different. The right-wingers are numerous, often even a majority, and they are often people who are not ashamed of being right-wing, which, for French television, is something totally new.
The philosophy professor Saïd Benmoufok, who writes a column for the left-wing weekly L'Obs, says that through the transmission of short extracts from its debate programmes on Twitter, etc., this channel has become a major actor in the French culture wars, popularising expressions such as wokeism, human rightsism, LGBT lobby and gender theory, which belong, he says, to the extreme right. CNews also, he says, frequently crosses the line into illegality.
In January, for example, the journalist Judith Weintraub said on CNews that Ukrainian refugees don't pose the same problems of integration and cultural difference as certain Africans do. This is incitement to discrimination against certain refugees because of their origin. Also, Jean-Claude Dacier, a regular CNews contributor, said, "The Muslims don't give a fig about the Republic. They don't even know what the word means. Again, incitement to discriminate."
Comment for which CNews fired this contributor. The channel turned down an offer of an interview, but pointed out that the head of the media watchdog has stated that CNews does respect the rules when it comes to the expression of diverse points of view. For the time being, then, to the delight and horror of the French, CNews looks set to continue.
Oui, dans le principe, mais non.
Allez. Le problème, c'est que c'est pas dans le principe. Vous avez expliqué que oui, si c'est.
That report by John Lawrenson. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
We found footprints that show us that they are still alive. We can conclude that belongs to the girls.
Rescuers in Colombia are optimistic about finding four children a month after their plane crashed in the Amazon. Japan has one of the world's oldest populations and fairly strict immigration rules. It also has a falling birth rate, which on Friday hit a record low. The Prime Minister has announced a $25 billion plan to try to reverse the trend, saying it's the last chance before the youth population starts to decline drastically. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Sanjay Dasgupta, told me more.
It is such a problem that, as you well point out, the Prime Minister has taken it up as one of his main priorities. He says that boosting the birth rate is a priority. The average Japanese woman has a fertility rate of 1.2565. Now, that's just a number, but you have to put it in perspective. The rate considered minimum to maintain a stable population, that is not an increasing population, but a stable one, is 2.07.
So this implies that Japan's population is going to keep falling.
It does. Why do countries need more people? Simply put, a bigger population means a bigger workforce. A bigger workforce means higher GDP. Japan is a particular case in the point because it has an aging population. The experts have looked at the figures and said the pandemic is a big reason for the falling population in Japan, because the COVID-19 pandemic has led to fewer marriages, hence fewer children, and at the same time has boosted death rates. The last year that we have figures for, which is 2022, the birth rate in Japan fell by 5% and the death rate at the same time increased by 9%.
And so the government's going to spend $25 billion to try to boost that birth rate in Japan. Will that work? And if not, what are the alternatives? Could they resort to perhaps more immigration?
Now, this is a big question. Japan has traditionally been a low immigration society. Immigration is not a panacea, but it is a way out. Not all societies, Japan is a case in the point, Russia is another, are keen on immigrants filling up the population deficit. I think the effort is to boost the population, the birth rate of the country itself, rather than fill the vacuum by importing workers, to provide things like childcare, debt relief to young married couples, to entice them to have more children. Whether young couples tend to turn away from having children simply for the unavailability of childcare is an open question.
Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Sanjay Desgupta. European football's governing body UEFA has charged the Roma manager, Jose Mourinho, with using abusive language against the referee of the Europa League final. The Italian side lost on penalties to the Spanish club Sevilla after a hot-tempered match. Crowds of angry Roma fans were later filmed harassing the English official, Anthony Taylor, and his family at the airport. More details from Andy Swiss.
Footage on social media of Anthony Taylor trying to protect his family from a mob of angry fans at Budapest Airport has once again raised questions about the treatment of referees. Just hours earlier, Taylor had shown a record 14 yellow cards during a bad-tempered Europa League final, including one to the Roma manager Jose Mourinho, whose team went on to lose. After the match, in the stadium car park, Mourinho confronted Taylor and launched an abusive tirade. Amid the expletives, Mourinho called the referee a disgrace, and UEFA have now charged him with using insulting or abusive language against an official. Meanwhile, the harassment of Taylor at the airport was described as unjustified and abhorrent by the referees' body PGMOL, while the president of the Referees Association, Paul Field, said Taylor's treatment raised serious questions for the authorities.
Anthony is very disappointed about how it all ended, but more importantly, he's okay. Every country in Europe has got problems with respect towards match officials.
Budapest Airport says an Italian citizen has been charged with a fray. But amid increasing concern about the abuse suffered by referees at grassroots level, the treatment of elite officials is now also under scrutiny.
Our sports news correspondent Andy Swiss. The Colombian military says it is close to finding four children missing since their plane crashed in the Amazon rainforest a month ago. The discovery of a rudimentary shelter, some half-eaten fruit and a fresh footprint have raised hopes. So, do they believe that the children aged 13, 9, 4 and 11 months are still alive? Julian Marshall spoke to General Pedro Sanchez, head of the rescue mission.
I believe profoundly because we found footprints that show us that they are still alive. 6 days ago, our team found two footprints that we can deduce, we can conclude that belongs to the girls who has 13 years old. And the footprints had about 24 to 48 hours. That means that we are very close. However, it is very difficult to find because the density of the jungle is very high. So you cannot view more than 60 feet behind. But also 16 hours of the days is raining. So it is difficult to view or to hear the children.
As well as the footprints, have you found any other evidence of the children possibly being alive?
Yes, we found some things that they used the bottle to give the baby. We found two diapers. Those were used to the baby. We found also scissors, and because the distance from the accidents around maybe 500 meters, that means 1,500 feet, that confirmed that they are alive. And when we compare the condition of the babies, even though the jungle is very hostile, they are indigenous. They know about how to survive inside of the jungle.
Do you have any way of communicating with the children?
To communicate with the children, we are using sounds from the airplanes, from the helicopters, but also we put inside of the jungle one sound using a portable electric generation power to produce sounds and lights. Inside of the jungle, you can hear that sounds about 3 kilometers around. We use that sounds alternative between the hours. 1 hour, we make a sound. Another hour, we make a silence. We send them flyers from the helicopters with message in Spanish, but also in Witoto, which is their language, to communicate with them. But also we put whistles inside of the jungles with the objective that they use those elements to give us a signal about where they are.
How much longer will you go on looking for the children?
Until we find them. That is the mission.
General Pedro Sanchez talking to Julian Marshall. It is one of Scotland's most important historical documents, and some say it supports the case for independence. Now, the Declaration of Arbroath is due to go on display in the capital, Edinburgh, for the first time in almost two decades. Experts say it can only be exhibited occasionally to ensure its long-term preservation. The details from our Scotland correspondent, Lorna Gordon.
The Declaration of Arbroath was written during a turbulent period in Scotland's history. During the long war of independence with England, Robert the Bruce had secured a win at Bannockburn, but remained unrecognised as Scotland's king. The barons of Scotland appealed to the Pope for help, using words that have resonated down the centuries since.
While 100 of us remain alive, never will we be subject to the King of England. And then further on, just in that same line, is the bit that Scots say that they are fighting for freedom alone.
Dr. Alan Borthwick is the head of medieval and early modern records at the National Records of Scotland.
It's an extraordinary text. It encapsulates an awful lot about what the Scots thought about themselves as a nation in 1320 and their right to be an independent kingdom, not subject to the English king.
The 14th century sheepskin parchment is fragile.
Yes, this one here, it's got a former repair along the top.
We were given rare access as conservators inspected the document for historical damage ahead of its going on display. Our movements as we filmed the precious letter were carefully monitored to keep it safe.
We're getting a wee bit close.
OK. Okay.
The head of conservation at the National Records of Scotland is Linda Ramsey. She says it's not the only 14th century document they're entrusted with, but it is the most famous.
A public record is something that you can't just keep when nobody sees it. There is an interest, and quite rightly, we have to make that possible.
Do you feel nervous when this leaves the archives?
Yes, we like it to be back sleeping in its bed, in the store secure.
The Declaration of Arbroath, interpreted by some as claiming Scotland's independence, is a precious piece of history. Words now hundreds of years old, on a theme that still grips the nation today.
Lorna Gordon. Finally, one of the most prolific and successful American songwriters of all time, Cynthia Vile, has died at the age of 82. She and her husband, Barry Mann, wrote some of the biggest hits of the 20th century. Sandra Berg looks back at her life.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips.
You've Lost That Loving Feeling was the most played song on American TV and radio in the last century. It was written by Cynthia Vile and her husband Barry Mann, who together produced dozens of hits. Men dominated the music industry then, but Cynthia Vile said she never felt any door was closed to her. The couple worked closely with producers such as Phil Spector and performers. On Broadway was originally intended for a girl group, but then they rewrote it with the Drifters. Cynthia Vile told one interviewer that successful songs were like little novels, painting a picture of the human condition. Through the 70s, 80s and afterwards, she carried on writing songs, sometimes with her husband, sometimes with others. Many of their compositions have stood the test of time. Make Your Own Kind of Music, written 54 years ago, features in one of this summer's most promoted films, Barbie.
Sandra Berg on Cynthia Vile, who's died aged 82. And that is all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast very soon. This edition was mixed by Darren Garrett and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.